Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, folks. This is a fundraising pitch. You might have noticed that the show's been on hiatus for about the last 6 months. Okay, why? Well, I've been producing The Koreaphile ad-free for the last 3 years. That's 68 episodes. And it takes a lot of time and effort to track down interviews, research, edit, and produce the show. Of course, I gotta work to pay the rent, which doesn't leave a lot of time to focus on the podcast. So I'm wondering, is it possible to turn this into a part-time job? Maybe, but I need your help. Go to patreon.com/thekoreaphile and throw me a few dollars a month. For the price of a cup of coffee at Tom and Tom's, for the cost of a sandwich at Isaac Toast, you can help turn this podcast into a sustainable project. And patrons get perks. For an ongoing donation of just $4 a month, you'll have access to extra content that you won't find anywhere else online, including bonus interviews and special subscriber-only episodes. If you can afford to contribute a little more every month, $10 donation gets you exclusive VIP access to information about upcoming guests and the opportunity to submit questions for future episodes, a kind of executive producer position. But hey, every dollar helps a lot, and listeners like you can help to sustain this podcast. So if you can contribute, again, go to patreon.com/thekoreaphile and donate a few bucks. Thanks. All right. Here's the episode. Broadcasting from Montreal, this is The Koreaphile, a bi-weekly podcast about music, culture, and society from around the Korean Peninsula and the world. I'm Andre Goulet. On this episode... What's it like to work on an archaeological excavation in Gyeongju? Born in Seoul and raised in the United States, Rachel Lee's first dig in the historical capital of the Silla dynasty was also her first visit to her country of origin. Join us for a conversation about the differences between household and mortuary archaeology, popular misconceptions of the swashbuckling Indiana Jones-style archaeologist, and a description of a typical archaeological research trip in Korea. This is the second of a two-part interview. So when did you first become interested in archaeology? And is the life of an archaeologist what you imagined it would be?
To answer your first question, when did I want to be an archaeologist? I've always wanted to be an archaeologist since I was a little girl.
Really?
Yeah.
How did that play out when you were a kid?
So I was very into documentaries on, you know, classical... like archaeology. So that was my first exposure to what archaeology was. I would watch documentaries on Pompeii, and I was like, wow, that's really fascinating that we can still recover things that were so old. And I also read National Geographic a lot. So I was exposed to it as a child, and it was always something that I wanted to do, among other things. But it was in high school when I really wanted to be an archaeologist. So I went into college with plans to major in anthropology, which in America, archaeology is a subdiscipline of anthropology.
Is it what you imagined it would be as a kid or as a high school student? Is it what you dreamed of?
Both, because yes, I think archaeology is exciting because you're discovering. You're just constantly discovering things. But at the same time, I didn't realize it was such hard work. Like, I knew it was going to be hard work, but it's not always, you know, the fun stuff that you imagine it to be. It's very rigorous physically and mentally. So I'm working under the sun, and this is, you know, all archaeologists, we often work during the summer, so it's very hot. It's 8+ hours a day of physical exertion, and then you have to think the whole time. You're thinking, like, what is this pattern I'm seeing? What is this thing that I'm digging? How does this fit into the general framework, the theoretical framework that we have? So it's both physically and mentally exhausting, it could be, yeah.
You're finishing your graduate studies at the University of Michigan, right?
Yes.
Am I correct in saying that this university has a historical reputation for archaeological research?
It certainly does. We have a very stellar faculty, and they were a lot of them were key in some of the movements that we've had, like intellectual movements that we had in archaeology. And a lot of good, really great scholarship has come out of Michigan.
The romanticized notion of archaeology is a little bit Indiana Jones, a little bit Tomb Raider. How inaccurate are these characterizations in terms of what you guys really do?
Well, if you're gonna go into archaeology based on those movies, then you're gonna be sorely disappointed, because we're not, I guess, we're not treasure hunters, right? So we're not always finding the things that you would typically find in a museum of art. So the things that we dig up, sometimes somebody might consider quite ugly, but to us it's fascinating. So even a plain piece of ceramic with, you know, a broken piece of ceramic will tell us something interesting that we're trying to figure out. But to the layman expecting, you know, valuable objects, beautiful things, it might not mean much. So it's quite different, but I think the excitement is there, you know. So when you see these movies, they kind of impose a sense of, wow, the exotic, right? And although, you know, we're not being chased by anything and we're not finding the prettiest objects all the time, but I think most archaeologists would agree that we find our work really exciting, and that's the reason why we keep doing it.
You've excavated in Greater Jinju with your New Moon research.
Yes.
Where else have you excavated?
I've excavated in Gyeongju, which is to the east of Jinju.
And Gyeongju is really famous for being like the seat of royalty for the Silla dynasty.
Of course.
So were you also doing household research?
No, I was digging tombs in Gyeongju. It's really, if you're into mortuary archaeology, Gyeongju is the place to go, because you have very elaborate, wonderful tombs that you can excavate.
So mortuary archaeology in Gyeongju, these are the hill tombs that we see everywhere.
Yes.
So what's that like to go investigate something like that? Like, you dig a hole in and just gain access and peek around?
It was actually my first excavation in Korea, because prior to my Gyeongju excavation, I never actually stepped inside the country of Korea. You know, I was born there, but I immigrated to the U.S. as a baby. So Gyeongju was my first experience in both Korea as well as Korean archaeology. So it was, you know, it was like the greatest introduction that you could have, because I was in such an important city for the Korean culture, for archaeology. So it was wonderful to be able to excavate elite tombs. It was, we found great, beautiful objects, a lot of beautiful pottery, and that was very exciting for me.
How does mortuary archaeology compare to household excavation?
Mortuary archaeology is concerned with graves, tombs, and cremation. In Korea particularly, you get, you know, graves of commoners and you get graves of elites. So if you're going to be excavating in Gyeongju, chances are you're going to be excavating elite tombs. Of course, there are non-elite tombs too, but a lot of the excavation opportunities are at these large mounded tombs. Household archaeology in Korea, once again, you have rich households and you have common, typical households, but we're not targeting you know, for instance, tombs, you can clearly see which are the best tombs, you know, the best as in the wealthiest, because they're big and they protrude from the landscape. Whereas with household archaeology, it's not as self-evident from the beginning. Of course, you're going to, you know, find houses that are quite well off, but you're also going to find mostly households or houses that were more average or, you know, not as well off.
You've also worked on excavations or surveys in China?
Yeah, so in China, I'm on a team directed by a professor at UCLA named Li Min, and we were doing a survey project. So surveys are different from excavation, so we're not actually excavating or digging anything, but it's still archaeological work because we're doing what we call a systematic survey. So we lay out grids of where we're going to walk, and so we walk typically in a line, and we pick up or we document what we find in that line that we designate. So, you know, the line can range from, you know, 10 meters to however long, 30 meters or whatever. And we walk that line, and then we find typically where we're working in China, which is Chufu in Shandong province, we find lots of ceramics. And so if there's a ceramic from a particular period, then we can use that evidence, the ceramic sherd, as evidence for occupation during that period.
What kind of shards are they? Are they just sort of run-of-the-mill clay? Is it something? Is it anything special, or is it just like a bunch of junk left behind that's been tilled up, like in a farmer's field?
You get everything. So you can get earthenware, which are usually the earliest pottery, and those, you know, they can be elaborately decorated with like cord marks. But, you know, they're not going to be, I guess, quality-wise, they're not as well-made as porcelain. And so porcelain are, you know, very beautiful blue and white pottery. And so we get the whole spectrum of things. So in that sense, you know, you can get a snapshot of all the different period in which people were living there.
So it's different in the sense that in Korea you excavate, in China you survey. What else was different between the two experiences?
I guess archaeologically, in China, because we're not actually digging, we're able to work with a larger piece of land. So larger piece of land in a relatively fast amount of time. So you get a broader view of how things were. And that's very valuable because, you know, the more horizontal view is can answer specific questions. In Korea, we're excavating. And, of course, we can excavate, you know, a large piece of land. But it takes longer. And it's immediately you get more of a vertical view, right? So you are digging down rather than across. So you get a lot more detail in terms of what you're working with in terms of the archaeological remains. So you sort of trade off one for the other.
Tell me about a typical research trip to Korea. I just want to kind of imagine what it's like. You land in Incheon, then do you take the KTX down to Gyeongju or Jinju? Where do you stay? What's your daily work like? Is it 9 to 5? Just tell me a little bit, like the length of the trip.
So I land in Seoul, in Incheon. And the project that I've most frequently been on is located in Jinju. So, you know, after a day of recuperating from the jet lag, I spend typically a night in Incheon. And then I take the bus, the intercity bus, to Jinju. Straight to Jinju. There's a direct connection from the airport to Jinju. Yeah. So I go to Jinju, and depending on the year, there could be a, what we say in archaeology, a dig house, which is where, like, you know, some or all of the excavation team members live. So we'll, you know, have a house and people will occupy different rooms and we share, you know, the common area. So I'll either go there and I'll live with them, or most recently I've been living in these motels where it's, you know, it's relatively cheap. It's like $50, $51 a night.
Yeah, kind of like trashy love motels or just sort of off-brand motels. But backing up a sec, when you're taking that bus down after getting off the plane and recuperating for a night, what are you thinking about when you're looking out the window and on your way to the dig house or to the hotel?
Yeah, when I'm on the bus going to Jinju, for example, I have usually, you know, a lot of things that I am considering in my head, because when it's, you know, I'm thinking about what I need to accomplish, what I need to talk to people about. It's a lot of logistical things, because excavation is complicated in that it involves a lot of people, and I'm not part of the actual team that I work with. You know, they're employed, whereas I'm not employed. I'm coming with their generosity. I'm being allowed to dig with them. So. So it's more complicated. So I'm kind of figuring out who I need to talk to, and if I have all my equipment, you know, sometimes I forget my trowel or something like that, and I'll have to go to like an E-Mart or something and pick up like foil or things that I need to excavate.
So what's a typical day look like? How early does it start?
It starts around between 8 or 9. That's when the site opens, and we have breaks between meals. So between, you know, the start of the day, we'll have a, and between the start of the day and lunch, we'll have a break. And then we'll have lunch at noon, and then we'll have like 2 more breaks in the afternoon, and then we'll end typically at 5 o'clock. And then everyone just goes home after that, except, you know, I go to my hotel room, or not hotel room, I go to my motel room, and everyone goes to where they live.
Is it like grueling work, or is it work that's so exciting that you're just sort of like propelled through the day?
Both. Sometimes it's, sometimes it can get kind of grueling in the sense that there's not much mental stimulation because you're digging up the same thing over and over again. But then once in a while you'll dig up something that's really meaningful for you as an archaeologist. So something that will help you answer some of your research questions, and then it gets really exciting, and then you're propelled by that discovery that you make, and you know it gives you the energy to keep going.
That's the Kreophile for this week. You can find new episodes of the Kreophile on iTunes and Stitcher, and as a featured contributor at KreaFM.net, KreaBridge.net, BlogTalkRadio.org, and AngloInfoSoul, all of whom you should really like on Facebook. And if you like what you hear, like us on Facebook, too. Also, please leave a review of the show wherever you subscribe. It'll help new listeners discover the show. 5 stars is good. We're also on Twitter with daily links and information about the peninsula at The Kreophile. Music on this episode is from Lee Se-jin with her 1978 single, Solpo Mao. And tune in on May 11th for the first of a 2-part conversation with academic Michael Prentice about his undercover research at a South Korean corporation as we go inside the Chaebol. Until then, thanks for listening. From Montreal, I'm Andre Goulet.
Hey,
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.